As you know, it's important to me that the supplements I recommend and use are of the highest quality. That's why I stock the Protocol for Life Balance product line at my online dispensary, drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. Protocol for Life Balance offers a wide range of professional-grade products using ingredients backed by strong scientific research, including a suite of supplements that support mood and sleep: L-tryptophan, 5-HTP, GABA, and L-theanine. This collection provides essential amino acids and a serotonin precursor that support relaxation, restful sleep, and the regulation of mood and sleep-wake cycles, and are available in various potencies tailored to your specific needs. For more information and to order, just go to drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. That's drhoffman.com/protocolforlifebalance. Protocol for Life Balance is an A-rated GMP manufacturer of premium dietary supplements created for healthcare practitioners. Their formulations are based on the latest advances in nutritional science. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today we're going to talk about all things related to thyroid. We have an expert. Dr. Antonio Bianco is a recipient of the American Thyroid Association's John B. Stanberry Thyroid Pathophysiology Medal. He's a professor of medicine and a member of the Committee on Molecular Metabolism and Nutrition at the University of Chicago, where he runs a laboratory funded by the National Institutes of Health to study thyroid hormones. He is also a former president of the American Thyroid Association, so he's eminently qualified to talk to us today. His recent book, Rethinking Hypothyroidism, Why Treatment Must Change and What Patients Can Do, is a primer for patients, their families, and their doctors that explains why the standard treatment for thyroid, for hypothyroidism, fails many, and the book offers an empowering call for change. So it's really a pleasure having you on the program, Dr. Bianco. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a pleasure. Thank you.
Okay, so it's a great book because I think it's a book that should be read by clinicians, health practitioners who treat patients with thyroid, because it really introduces some important concepts about the nuances associated with thyroid, because it would seem like kind of a straightforward proposition. You know, somebody has low thyroid, we check their blood, we do a test commonly referred to as the TSH test. The TSH is high, we treat, we fix the problem. Patient goes home, often the patient's fine, but so often patients are left high and dry. So tell us a little bit about your evolution, because obviously you trained as a conventional endocrinologist. You're an MD, PhD, so in addition to being a clinician, you've also done extensive research. You currently head up a laboratory that studies thyroid hormones, but tell us a little bit about your personal journey.
Well, I mean, I obviously graduated a long time ago, about 40 years ago, and I always treated my patients with hypothyroidism just using the standard of care, which is using levothyroxine at the doses that normalize TSH.
Right. Also known as Synthroid.
Well, yeah. Synthroid is the brand mark, yes. Yeah. So then, you know, at that point, what I learned was that once TSH has been normalized, patients should be symptom-free. Should be, you know, you just recovered everything and the patient should be as they were before the thyroid failed. You know, this is what I always done for decades, I have to say. And every now and then, I mean, you know, more now that, you know, once I start paying attention, I start realizing that I had several patients that came to me and said, you know, I don't feel well. And no, but the TSH is normal. No, but even though the TSH is normal, I don't feel well. And I have to tell you, I would dismiss this patient. I would just tell them, listen, your TSH is normal. Right. There's not much I can do right now. And you probably have something else going on.
Exactly.
And for many patients, I actually recommended going see a therapist, because we actually looked for other things, other comorbidities, other syndromes, couldn't find anything. I would just say, you know, I think you should go see a therapist. And, you know, people don't like that. And I
especially since the high percentage, the vast majority of patients are females. So it's a little bit of a patriarchal thing about this is, you know, you go to the endocrinologist, predominantly males. They say, you know, I'm sorry. You know, you're fine as far as I'm concerned. Perhaps you're depressed. Perhaps you're suffering from, you know, a psychiatric disorder. You need to talk to someone or maybe even take a medication, you know. And you look, there's no question that there can be multiple things happening with a patient, not just thyroid.
Right. Yeah. So this was my MO. And up until 2012, 2013, about 10, 12 years ago, I saw a patient. She was a teacher. She was devastated. She said, I had a total thyroidectomy and I had to quit my job because I couldn't go back and work. My brain didn't work. And I said, well, I just gave her the same speech. You know, something else is going on. Your TSH is normal. She left. 2 or 3 weeks later, I came to my office, another teacher that also resigned because of the same symptoms. And I said, you know what? There's got to be something wrong. I mean, first I checked to see if it was from the same school, if there's a virus going on or something. No, totally different places. So at that point, I said, I think we got something wrong here. And I started to, what I did was I went into literature search. I started, what has been published about this? And I saw that this was actually more common than I actually realized. Patients that were dissatisfied, even though everything was okay with the treatment for hypothyroidism. And at the same time, because I run a lab, I started asking questions that we could actually investigate in my own lab. And I started sort of slowly switching a little bit the direction of my research to actually understand when we treat someone with levothyroxine or T4, what are we doing and how well are we doing? And after several years, I came to realize that we got a lot of things wrong and that I was just repeating things. I was repeating to my patients dogmas that I learned that have no basis whatsoever, no basis. And I felt so upset and frustrated because I was repeating something that maybe I should have gone and did my homework. But you don't question what you learned from your professors, right? From your masters. I mean, if they told me this, it's got to be right. I don't have to second guess everything. But in this case, I realized that several dogmas were just baseless. It was just an opinion that was being propagated over and over and over again. And it changed my mindset about this. It was not easy because there is a strong peer pressure in the thyroid world against questioning the efficacy of the treatment with levothyroxine. The treatment with levothyroxine was developed in the 1970s, and it was like the premier, translation of basic sciences into clinical application. So there were a series of discoveries that were made, amazing discoveries, this T4 to T3 conversion, and immediately that was translated into clinic. So how dare you question all of this thing that has been established, so well established? So there was a lot of peer pressure, and I had to be, at first I was concerned because am I right? Is this... Why am I the only person that's looking at this?
Is it worth staking a career on this? I mean,
that's
this
correct.
Is a little bit heretical. Yeah.
Right. Am I missing something here? But the more I delve into this thing, I realize that no, this is not well established. And today I ask, I go to meetings and I stand up and I ask, you're saying this, what's the basis for you to say this? Where is the data that supports what you're saying? This is just opinion, your expert opinion that you're propagating without a basis. So I think that it's been a journey. I feel very rewarded. I'm happy. I'm happy with myself because I thought that I can, you know, at least now when I say something, I know I believe it because I actually read and or either things that I discovered in my lab or other labs, and I'm very excited with this.
Talk to us a little bit about the history of thyroid therapy. You know, starting with the recognition that there was such a thing as hypothyroidism, which right. I believed happened in the early 19th century, and then with the use of animal glands at first, and then there was, as you mentioned, the science, this discovery of a new and improved way that kind of gets past the unreliability of ground-up pig thyroid, for example.
Right. No, this is actually fascinating. Towards the end of the 19th century and beginning of the 20th century, they realized there was such a condition known as hypothyroidism. And the hypothyroid patients were mostly admitted to asylums. They were like nutty because hypothyroidism can lead to psychosis, can lead to a lot of psychiatric disorder if not treated. So they were capped in this places, and the first treatment that was developed was a transplant, believe it or not.
Wow.
So they took a thyroid gland from a sheep and implanted in a psychiatric patient that had the severe hypothyroidism.
Wow.
And so the paper has been was published by a psychiatrist and a surgeon, so that was the combination, and so it worked well for a few months, but then it passed. The effect passed.
It was so, rejected because the foreign tissue would be rejected by the body.
Right, right. I think what they said was the tissue dissolved.
Yeah,
so they had the idea said, you know, obviously the transplant didn't work with all the arteries and stuff, but maybe the juice, and they use that word, the juice of the thyroid, as it dissolved under the skin of that patient, is what did the trick. So then they had the idea of preparing the juice and injecting it under the skin, and that worked too. So they could treat patients with hypothyroid just by injecting a thyroid juice. And then, you know, this was very painful, didn't work very well. So then they started drinking the juice and ultimately eating a steak, a thyroid steak. It was about like a one third of a thyroid, a sheep thyroid. It would be lightly cooked in the morning and taken with bread for breakfast.
Okay.
Yeah. And then it didn't taste very well. There's some recipes to make it taste a little better. But then they had the idea of drying that thyroid and putting in a capsule and taking it. And that's what's called desiccated thyroid extract or just thyroid, which is sold up to this day on the pharmacies, like a powder of thyroid. Today in the U.S., the thyroid doesn't come from sheep, it comes from pigs.
Right.
So all the thyroid powders that we have are just pig thyroid.
And one of the most popular brands is Armour Thyroid. It's actually the British spelling, A-R-M-O-U-R. And of interest is they also make hot dogs, Armour hot dogs. And then Armour Thyroid, because, you know, you take the whole animal and you utilize all its parts. And, you know, a valuable part is they they refine them, desiccate them, and concentrate them in a capsule. Yeah.
That's how it was done. It was born in Chicago, actually, because the slaughterhouses of Armour Swift, they were here in Chicago. So Armour Thyroid started here. And so... And that was a super success story. So since 1900, they've been selling desiccated thyroid extract. There are other brands as well. And up to 1970, that was the standard of care. The gold standard for treatment of hypothyroidism was just taking some tablets with the pig's thyroid. Now, doctors didn't like that very much, although it was very effective. because there were the potency of those tablets was inconsistent.
Yeah.
So it was not really easy to straightforward to calibrate the potency of the pills. And so some batches had more potency, some batches less potency. And even between different two brands, it was different potency. So it was a little bit, but so in the books I read of that time, they would just say the doctor has to get used to several brands, and because they all have their differences in terms of potency. And once you're used to, you're going to be able to work with your patient. Hmm. And that's how, I mean, you know, the other day,
It was a little bit of a seat of the pants approach, because this is before the origin of blood tests, which could pinpoint thyroid function. So it was more like when you reach the subjective endpoint of the patient feels good, the patient's no longer cold, the patient's no longer constipated, the skin is no longer dry, the facial edema is reduced, you know, all the symptoms, concomitant symptoms of thyroid were resolved. That would be like, okay, we're good.
Right. So you touched on a very important point. The goal of the treatment was to make the patient feel good.
It was to
resolve the symptoms of hypothyroidism. Mm-hmm. There were some blood tests that were very primitive tests that could give an indication to the doctor what was going on. One of them was called PBI. Mm-hmm. They also measured oxygen consumption, very rudimentary tests.
Resting metabolism, resting
that's
metabolic
correct.
Rate.
Yes.
Yeah, that whole
yeah.
thing.
But the
yeah.
goal was to resolve the symptoms, right? Yeah. So that was the... Now, John Kennedy, for example, he was on desiccated thyroid extract. Mm-hmm. So everyone that was diagnosed with hypothyroidism before 1970 was treated with desiccated thyroid extract, period. Mm-hmm. Now, in 1970, there was a great discovery. Two doctors in Boston and one in New York, they discovered that T4, which is the thyroid hormone, gets converted to T3, which is a stronger hormone. T4 is a very weak hormone. T3 is a very strong hormone. Mm-hmm. So desiccated thyroid extract from the pig contains both. It's a mixture of T4 and T3. Mm-hmm. Now, those guys in Boston and New York, they realized that if you only give T4 to a patient, the patient will convert T4 to T3, and you're going to find a lot of T3 in the blood of those patients. Mm-hmm. So they said, well, you know what? We don't have to give both T4 and T3 mm-hmm. in the pig's thyroid, because this pig's thyroid, first of all, it's pig's thyroid, and then, you know, it's inconsistency. The doses... Yep. This is not like in the 70s, they value the fact that, oh, T4 is synthetic. We can measure it in mm-hmm. the exact micrograms. So this was,
we're improving on Mother Nature. We're improving on.
Exactly. Yeah. It's synonymous with a better treatment, more accurate. So they just switched. Mm-hmm. In 10 years, the sales of Armour Thyroid went to almost zero. Excuse me, desiccated thyroid extracts.
Yeah.
And the sales of levothyroxine went through the roof. Up to this day, levothyroxine is either the first or the second or the third most prescribed medicine in this country. Hmm. Its market is billions. Mm-hmm. So it's a phenomenal success story for levothyroxine. Replaced desiccated thyroid extract, and it's ingrained in every doctor's mind that when you have someone with hypothyroidism, that's how you treat.
Right.
Now, this is straightforward as you described. The problem is with that switch in the therapy, we no longer, what was the goal of therapy? Was no longer resolve symptoms of hypothyroidism. The goal of the therapy was to normalize the levels of a hormone that's called TSH. Mm-hmm. So,
which became measurable right around 1970, because
it was there simultaneously. Yes, it was around the same time they developed this test to measure TSH, and they saw that TSH is high when you have hypothyroidism. But then, So what you do is you treat patients with levothyroxine so they bring to the normal range the TSH levels again. And once they are within the normal range, you're done. So no longer we were asking the patient, how do you feel? Should I adjust the dose based on how you feel? No, you just adjust the dose based on TSH levels. So there were several changes. And as a result of these changes in the 70s, a new category of patients started to develop. What's this category? Patients that have a normal TSH are treated with levothyroxine, but they don't feel well. It's funny because before 1970, there are no reports of that category of patients. Hmm. We just didn't have. Now, after the goal of the therapy was to normalize TSH with levothyroxine, then these patients started to show up. The first place that they actually noticed this was in the UK. It was a psychologist. She said, you know, she wrote a little article and said, you know, most of my patients are hypothyroid. I don't understand. Why is that? I mean, I'm doing therapy for a lot of patients and they're hypothyroid. Why? Because that was the reflex. The doctors will send for therapy those patients that couldn't fix. And then because of that, a doctor in Wales, in Cardiff, he did a survey. And he realized that patients that are taking levothyroxine as a group, they have a lower quality of life. They have cognitive problems. They're unhappy patients.
So-called brain fog.
Yeah, they have brain fog. They have all sorts of impairments of the cognitive abilities and mood disorders. Not so much, but mostly cognition and quality of life. Mm-hmm. And but that was, you know, even though that was being observed in the UK, in the Netherlands, here, even in Oregon, here in the U.S., the societies that write those clinical guidelines, they were just ignoring that. Mm-hmm. Here in the U.S., if you read the guidelines, you would just say, treat patients with levothyroxine. They wouldn't even question the effectiveness of levothyroxine. They wouldn't even tell us, oh, you know, be aware that some patients, it's a minority, but there are some patients that don't do well on levothyroxine. No, I never saw that. So we were not warned that those patients were, even though the papers were there, this was being published. So we were always told treatment with levothyroxine is the gold standard and should be effective and safe. Now, amazingly enough, when I started digging into this, I realized that, you know, when you have a drug, you go to the FDA and you ask for approval. The first thing the FDA was going to say is, oh, yeah, we need to do clinical trials because we need to establish if this drug that you have is effective and how much effective, how effective, and if the drug is safe. And I could not believe when I realized that levothyroxine was approved without a single clinical trial.
Kind of on spec, because it made a lot of sense, clearly, right?
Exactly. It was based on expert opinion. Mm-hmm. I think that it's a little bit, I mean, I would love to talk to someone, the FDA, that would explain to me why that happened. Mm-hmm. What was the rationale that led them to do it? Because to this day, we don't know how effective levothyroxine is.
Right.
The reason we don't know is we never had a clinical trial to answer that question. And why we don't have? Because a clinical trial like that is going to cost tens of millions of dollars. It's got at least $20 to $25 million.
Sure.
Because it's going to require hundreds of patients, multi-center. This is a lot of money. Who has to pay for that is the pharmaceutical company that wants to put the drug on the market.
Yeah.
But we missed that boat.
Yeah.
The FDA should have asked they would have paid for it.
Yeah.
And now they're not going to pay now. And the NIH doesn't have $25 million to pay for a trial on a drug that has been approved and being used for a number of years. So
what role did the pharmaceutical companies play in ensconcing this in the orthodoxy? Because as a young physician, you were introduced to this. This is the way to go. What were some of the ways that the big pharma, through education programs, through outright grants for research and patient advocacy groups, and all the various shenanigans that they undertake to support the access to their drug of choice, to what extent did that occur?
Well, I mean, I think today is different, right? It changed. So whatever I'm going to say now, it doesn't occur anymore in these days, because there were standards that were changed. For example, when I, as a young physician, I was used to talking to those pharmaceutical reps. They would come and visit your clinic, leave some samples behind and literature to distribute for the patients.
Maybe some
and,
lunch.
Right. You would go to the doctor's office and you would find all of these things like pens and at the same time, the reps will take you for dinner in fancy steakhouses. There will be dinners with 10, 12 doctors, and they will bring a key opinion leader, like a big guy, a big expert, and they would just explain or give a lecture. It was sort of a marketing / scientific, but the focus of the lecture was to tell the attendees that, that drug is super good. Mm-hmm. So the companies making levothyroxine used those mechanisms a lot to influence the prescription habits of the physicians. And that's why desiccated thyroid extract went down so fast and levothyroxine went up so fast. So today, just to make clear, we understand, physicians in that work in an academic medical center are not allowed to go to these dinners, and
it's more stringent.
Pharmaceutical reps are not allowed in the hallways. They can't, if you find a sample of anything in your office, it's a violation. It has to be immediately destroyed. We're not allowed to have anything. So that's good. But it happened with the levothyroxine. I would say the pharmaceutical industry had a major role, because in addition to all of this, they also gave research grants for physicians. So there was a lot of money. It's in my book. I think something like $10 million was distributed to the physician scientists or the scientists in the thyroid field during that time from the manufacturers of levothyroxine. Now, they would also give money to professional associations.
The Endocrine Society,
the American Thyroid Association, patient groups, they will all receive money. And, I remember, I have to tell, I was naive. I don't know what I was, but I remember being at a banquet of the American Thyroid Association in the 90s. And during that banquet, there was an announcement to pharmaceutical reps came into the room with a check. Those checks that are
The giant checks
blown out.
Yeah.
They had to be carried in the room. $1 million check that came into the room, that a donation for the American Thyroid Association. We were all happy. I was happy for them. Hmm. Little did I know that was just influence. That was just influence from the pharmaceutical company into our way of thinking. And so there was a lot of pressure from, and I have to say, the pharmaceutical company wants to sell their product. I have to say, I if anything, I put more blame on the physicians than on the pharmaceutical.
Because they're the gatekeepers. Because physicians are supposed to use their discretion to evaluate the products. I mean, that's we weren't trained to just merely obey guidelines and see drug reps.
Right. So I find it, and I find it amazing that a professional society receives money from the pharmaceutical company and writes guidelines to physicians on how that product that gave them the money is to be used.
Yeah.
And what's the best product? What's the best strategy? So there's a major conflict of interest here.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't get money and tell people how to use that drug at the same time. Like, I work at the University of Chicago, okay? So if I am a consultant for a company, and I don't have a say in which, if there are two products, insulin, two manufacturers of insulin, if I consult for one of them, they're not going to ask me which one should I recommend, because I have a conflict.
Sure.
I can't, it's the same thing. This professional society should not be writing guidelines if they take money from the pharmaceutical companies that are discussing their guidelines. That's it. I mean, this is so obvious, but for some reason, that doesn't, even today, this happens today.
Indeed.
Okay? And it shouldn't happen today.
Okay, this is a good point at which to pause, because our listeners know we divide our podcast into two parts. And in part two, I want to get into a little bit of a primer, we don't want to get into the weeds, about the physiology of thyroid hormones, because therein lies the key to the insights that your research has led you to, is an understanding of the variable roles of T4 and T3, how they work in the body, and how sometimes the use of synthetic thyroid, which is T4 alone, doesn't do the trick for many patients. For some, it does. For others, it leaves them high and dry. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Our guest is Dr. Antonio Bianco. And mention your website. You have a website which is diiodinase.com, is
org.
It? Okay.
.org, but .com works
okay.
as well.
Okay, where people can find out about your research. Of course, the book, which I recommend highly, is Rethinking Hypothyroidism, Why Treatment Must Change, and What Patients Can Do. More on that subject when we return. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast.